The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 20% off during the month of September.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski in Florence.
And me, Charles Arthur in London.
And me, Jemima Kish, also in London.
This week on the show.
You know, I feel so lucky that we are not under pressure to make money, especially when you're bought for $1 billion, right? I mean, you would assume that there would be some pressure.
We hear from the new director of business at Instagram, Emily White, on why Facebook's shiny toy is playing the long game on profits. We'll also be describing the silver lining behind the dark clouds looming over BlackBerry and why hipster Shoreditch in London will be the best vantage point from which to see the future this weekend. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Oh, BlackBerry. How quickly things change in the capitalist telecoms marketplace. You were the darling of the industry in 2008, raising an impressive $148 per share. Now, well, things aren't looking very good at all. Your shares are frozen at $8.23, but some say they're not even worth a penny more than $7. And the last few days have been stormy. Friday, BlackBerry announced heavy losses, and earlier this week, some brave soul announced their intention to acquire the company. The situation has come to a head, and joining us in the studio to decipher the tumultuous activity that's led us to this moment in telecom's time is Benedict Evans, an analyst at research group Ender's Analysis. Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about BlackBerry's last 7 days.
Well, BlackBerry are getting a bit accident prone. You sort of watch the news feed and you think, oh, they've suspended the stock again. Wasn't that last week? So at the end of last week, they had a profit warning and announced that their sales would be around half what people had previously been forecasting, that they were going to take close to $1 billion write-down on unsold stock of their new phones running their new platform, BlackBerry 10, mainly the Z Touch model. And then yesterday, one of their larger shareholders and Canadian fund management company announced that they're going to make a bid for the company at $4.7 billion. And if you subtract the cash that they have in hand, that's only a little bit over $2 billion for the actual business itself. So, as you say, down an awful long way from the glory days of 2007, 2008, when they thought they were going to rule the world. But in a sense, this has been coming for quite a long time. There was a little bit of a surge of enthusiasm at the beginning of the year when the new BB10 phones came out, and people who, well, a very small number of people looked at them and thought, these are fantastic, they're going to sell really well. And everyone else kind of looked at them and thought, well, maybe. And they didn't really sell at all. Even Nokia's Windows Phone is outselling them. So we have these two, we have these two giants of the pre-iPhone telecoms world. We have Nokia being bought by Microsoft, and we have RIM, BlackBerry, as they've renamed themselves, now looking like they're going to go private and be bought by this investment company. Now, the difference is that it's pretty clear that Microsoft think that Nokia's handset business has got a future and they're going to use it as the core of their attempt to become relevant in mobile. It isn't really clear at all that BlackBerry will still exist in 6 months' time. Certainly one of the most obvious outcomes is that they break it up and sell it for parts.
Yeah, I was going to ask Benedict, is this a garage sale, or is this, you know, a lifeline that's being given to BlackBerry?
Well, we haven't had an explicit statement from the buyers yet. It looks like I suppose it depends how enthusiastic or optimistic or deluded, depending on your point of view, they are. Certainly BlackBerry has a breakup value. There's value to the patents, and there's value to the BES business, that's to say the enterprise email server platform that's in thousands of companies around the world. And that would be worth something to a Hewlett-Packard or a Microsoft or an IBM or somebody who is interested in those customers. The hardware business probably has a negative value, that's to say it would cost you more to shut it down and give redundancy payments to all the staff than you're actually going to make out of it. And so, yeah, there's a sell it for scrap story. Alternatively, you could argue that these people think that you can turn it around, that it just needs a little bit more time and, you know, a bit of breathing space and a bit of reorientation, and it'll work. Now, in BlackBerry's profit warning, they said they were cutting, I think, 40% of their staff, abandoning the low-end market entirely and refocusing on what they call professional and prosumer customers with just four handsets. The problem is that that business is gone just as much as the low-end business is gone. And really what's happened to BlackBerry is that they became a business where something like two-thirds of the business was selling to low-end consumers and emerging markets, and one-third was selling to corporates. And the low-end and emerging market business is being killed by cheap BlackBerry and by WhatsApp and messaging services like that, which replaced BBM. And the corporate product is being killed by a combination of the iPhone and the iPad, and by products like Good Messaging from Good Technologies, which give effectively similar secure corporate messaging on iPhones and Android phones. And so, you know, most people in companies now can use an iPad or can use an iPhone to get secure access to their email in a way that they used to have to use a BlackBerry. So there's a nice comment in your companion in crime, the New York Times, a day or two ago, which said that the BlackBerry used to be the mark of being sort of a business elite, that you were important enough that your company gave you a BlackBerry. Now it's the other way around, that you're not important enough to get to choose your phone, and your company makes you carry a BlackBerry.
The New York Times has had people sort of think that journalists have a downer on a company. I mean, the New York Times did a piece a few months ago, it might have been a year ago even, sort of about people who said, yeah, I have a BlackBerry and my friends laugh at me. And that was the sort of the sign of the consumer turn, if you like. And now it's very much the business turn, that people don't want BlackBerries really, because they can't do things like increase the size on the text if they're using a BB7 phone. And with the BB10 phones, unless they've got a Q10 for the keyboard, then they tend not to be, I don't know, they're few and far between, let's say, the Z10s.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there's two sort of sets of issue here. One is that you can sit and poke holes in the offer that you get if you do buy a BB10. And it's the same issue with Windows Phone. You can sit and poke holes and say, well, I don't like this and I don't like that, and it should do this and it should do that. But the broader point is that actually that's not the comparison consumers are making. They're not comparing it of itself. They're saying, well, I could buy this, or I could buy an iPhone. Or a high-end Android phone. And if you compare BB10 or Windows Phone to the range of apps and features that you get on a high-end Samsung or a high-end HTC or a brand new iPhone, there's really not a fair comparison there. And so you have a diminishing number of people who are loyal to the keyboard. You have a small but growing number of people who like Windows Phone and who are buying them. And the sales are going up slightly. But you have a vastly higher number of people buying iPhones and Androids, and that's where all the developer attention goes. And both for BlackBerry and for Nokia, sales are now at a level that's too low for them to break even. So, you know, regardless of whether somebody listening to this podcast thinks, well, my Windows phone is great or my BlackBerry 10 is great, that's not really the point. Not enough people think that they're great for the companies to survive independently.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, Benedict. And you can keep an eye on this story at theguardian.com/technology. This week, Tesco launched their new, wait for it, tablet computer, the Huddle. And as far as I can tell, the only thing related to food is the operating system. Welcome to Guardian Technology reporter Samuel Gibbs in our London studio to tell us what this is all about. Hello and welcome to the podcast, Samuel.
Hello.
So tell us about the launch. Were there queues? What is this Huddle thing?
Well, Huddle is Tesco's first stab at making their own brand tablet. No, there were no queues. It wasn't an Apple-style launch, but it was quite a lot of hubbub around the event and anticipation. It's basically Tesco's cheap entry to battle the likes of the American giants like Amazon's Kindle Fire and Google's Nexus 7 tablet.
It's quite extraordinary, actually, isn't it? This idea of a supermarket launching a piece of hardware like this. Is it unusual for something like this to happen?
Supermarkets, yes, but not retailers. Of course, Amazon's had their Kindle Fire in the marketplace for about 3 years now. They basically used it as a foothold to sell their services through the tablet. Tesco's doing something similar. The Huddle isn't quite as locked down as Amazon's Kindle Fire, it is essentially a standard Android tablet with a little addition of Tesco's services and features. A little T in the bottom left-hand corner, one tap takes you to basically Tesco's shopping services for the groceries, but also Tesco Direct. You've got things like Tesco's club card management services, its own bank. You've also got things like Tesco's got several video services, which it acquired through a purchase of Blinkbox, the video streaming service. And out of that, it's built Clubcard TV, which is a family-friendly television streaming service. It's got Blinkbox Video too, which is a bit like Netflix or Love Film, although it's instead of being a subscription service, you've got effectively a pay-as-you-go offering, and the movies and TV shows often come out ahead of the likes of the subscription services like Netflix. You've also got things like Blinkbox Music and Blinkbox Books, which is going to be added at a later date. But to be honest, the Tesco elements of the Huddle are very much minimized just to that kind of additional apps. There is no generic skin over the top like many Android tablet manufacturers have put across, and the rest of the experience is very much stock Android.
So it's actually not just a Tesco portal. You'd be able to do the traditional other things that you would do with an Android tablet.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's unfettered access to the Google Play Store, so you've got everything that Android offers from that point of view. You've got the standard Google apps, things like Gmail, Google Chrome, YouTube, you name it, it's there, including Google's personal digital assistant, Google Now. So yes, this is a tablet that you can do everything you would normally do with any other tablet, and almost everything you can do with a PC too.
And if I was to comparison shop, is this cheaper than the other tablets that are on the market that are running the Android operating system? Or is this, you know, just the same?
It is very keenly priced. It's not quite the cheapest available at the moment. The Amazon Kindle Fire takes that crown with at £100 or £99. But that's with ad support and taking off the ads, which are annoying in my view, takes it to £109. And that's not even with a full an HD screen. When you're looking at starting price of an HD screen, at least 720p, you're looking at £160 or £159. So yes, it's very keenly priced. And in fact, what Tesco's is doing is leveraging its club card points system to effectively allow you to buy the tablet at a cheaper rate. So through what it's called its club card boost system, if you pay with just club card vouchers, you can get the Huddle for £60, which 100% undercuts almost everything else on the market and anything that's anywhere near as good as the Huddle.
That's pretty extraordinary. Jemima, I want to bring you in here. Who is the Huddle for?
Well, as a mainstream supermarket, and this is obviously a play that's going to appeal much more to a family market, they've done the obligatory bright colours and black, which is not that bright, but the purple and the red and the blue are quite nice and bright. So this is going to be on display in the supermarket to people who would probably never think of going into any kind of technology retailer or, God forbid, buying anything online. Whether it's Value Range or Tesco's Finest, I think is still, out for decision.
Every
and Charles,
helps.
Is the tablet market big enough for another device?
Certainly. I mean, the initial introduction of the iPad back in 2010 was, you know, it's a comparatively expensive device. It was new, it was untested. So that got a lot of the early adopters and people who'd be keen on getting an Apple device. Then last year, you saw the introduction of the Google Nexus 7 and the Amazon Kindle Fire over here in the UK, plus the iPad Mini. So that validated the sort of 7-8-inch space. And yeah, for a lot of people, it's interesting. And I think it's quite telling that within just 3 years of the iPad's launch, we've already migrated to 7-inch being one of the more popular sizes for the tablet. And it's actually now available in a mass market store where people are just, you know, being offered it at a very cheap price. And really, it's just sort of, yeah, why wouldn't you have a tablet? So it's, yeah, it's there's certainly plenty of space. I mean, the number of tablets sold in the UK is comparatively small compared to the number of households. I mean, you're talking sort of single-digit millions sold compared to, I think it's something like 20 million households, 22 million households. There's a lot of space for it to move into.
Why do you think that they have jumped on this bandwagon? Is Tesco known particularly as an innovative retailer in this space? I know that, you know, they've offered other products in the past, but this seems to me like they're moving into a completely different direction, or they're throwing themselves behind this trend that Charles was just describing and really getting on board with it.
I think the interesting thing is that when you think about Tesco, you have to realize they've got enormous amounts of data through loyalty cards. What they're trying to do, it's a bit like Google. They're trying to collect more data about what people do and to get people using their products more often. So if someone uses the Tesco tablet to order their Tesco shopping, that's a win for Tesco, even if they are only breaking even on the sale of the tablet itself. If they're using it for the TV movie subscriptions, again, you know, that's time which is not available to be used on competitors' products. So it's all about share of attention, also getting a bit more information about the user. So it's very much the same sort of model that Google actually uses, except that Tesco also will sell you onions if you want them.
Jemima, is it too early to see the tablet market segment itself into different demographic profiles? You know, we are looking at a lot of retailers who are playing in this space, but obviously there are different aspects of each of them. There are different interests to each of the demographic markets who potentially could be using all of these tablets. So are we starting to see that? Are we starting to see these devices filling gaps in the market?
Well, arguably this indicates a kind of next generation of tablet use, really. I think it's less tribal than it used to be. There's a more mainstream market who are less, you know, they have less of a strict allegiance to Apple or to Google. And the mums in the supermarket who are going to see this tablet, it's no coincidence that Tesco stated when they launched it that this was for people who are intimidated by technology. And if you think about the proposition of a tablet being sold alongside your groceries, what it says about tablets is that they're something that we use every day, that the value is really, really important, and this is a very affordable device, and also that they're kind of essential to our lives. So this is about an audience who don't really think about, they probably won't even know the name Android, and actually they don't need to. It's a device they're going to use every day, and it's just made that accessible to a whole different segment of the population.
Well, see Samuel, try out The Huddle on theguardian.com/technology. This is the weekend to be in Shoreditch if you want to know about the future. The epicenter of hipster London and home to the capital's digital hub is the setting for innovation charity Nesta's Future Fest, a two-day tech and tech tangential love-in curated by Pat Kane. And Pat joins us down the line from Glasgow. Pat, welcome to the podcast. What have you got in store for us this weekend?
Oh, well, we have every single aspect and angle on the future I could possibly pull out of Creative London over the last year and a half. I mean, it's kind of three things. It's definitely a fest. Let's get that straight down the line. It's a festivity of the future. So that means a bit like Glasgow, a bit like Vintage, you can wander around and sample things at various paces and stages. So we have, you know, a classic TED Talk, 15, 18 minutes and you're off with a big hook of major speakers from a whole range of natural sciences, social sciences, technology, business. Lots of names, lots of big names like you know, George Bombio and J.P. Rangaswamy and founders of Skype and Bertolt Meyer, the Android, and Lily Cole. I mean, lots of very, very high-level speakers on a kind of TED stage. And then one thing I desperately wanted to do, because I've enjoyed so much immersive theatre in London over the last sort of 24 months, 36 months, is I wanted to get some of those cats in to do some creating of a space whereby you walk into a room and you're in 2025 or you're in 2035 or you're in 2045, you know, behaviorally as much as sitting in front of fancy bits of tech that might or might not work. So we have people that are basically evoking the future through behavior, through style, dress, scenarios, and that's a sort of central thing called the stage. And then we have a great seller in the bottom of the Shoreditch Town Hall, which is a bit like the kind of relationship between the Morlocks and the Eloy and the Time Machine. So below, it's all very sort of grimy and steampunk and the future and fragments. And so we have lots of hands-on things there. And then we have a classic sort of academic seminar stretch with joining up with the Oxford Martin School, who are doing something.
Well, Pat, if it's a fest, you've mentioned that there are lots of different stages. Are there going to be any technology jugglers?
There's actually going to be a technology magician, a guy called Stuart Nolan, who is both a fantastic adept at the old leisure demand and smuggling giant billiard balls up his T-shirt and pulling them out on a whim. But he's also an experimental psychologist, and he's going to do something called the future of deception, which is basically imagine that we're in a space where all those techno-telepathic rats have become an actual app, and the problem is to actually screen your thoughts away from other people, to presume that there's any privacy left in the known universe, rather than to think that you have any. And he's going to kind of, as it were, do a sort of archaeology of the future. What was it like to be able to be deceived and to deceive someone from the perspective of 2050? So, and that's just another example of how we're trying to make the future be an enjoyable, dramatic, immersive experience, as well as bits of tech you can put your hands on, as well as future gurus.
Well, what was your curation strategy, Pat? Because you've got a whole bunch of people from a whole bunch of different disciplines coming together. Yeah. What kinds of conversations are you hoping to inspire?
Well, I'm absolutely myself at the nexus of social sciences, arts, technology, deep core science. So I think the thing about the future is that at the very least, change comes at you from almost any angle. I mean, when you think about something like a Gangnam Style video, it's both, oh my God, this amazing evolution of South Korean bourgeois culture and virality in terms of social media. So, the future is almost entirely unpredictable. But what you can be ready for is the fact that it will be at the nexus between culture and science and behavior and technology and climate and politics, obviously. I didn't want this to be a depoliticized festival. It's kind of slightly the problem I have with a lot of futurist festivals is they don't address things like governance or political economy or power and money. So we have Paul Mason, a guy I've been a great fan of, ex of Newsnight and now digital cultural editor of Channel 4. He's doing one of the keynotes. Sadie Kreese, who's a professor of cybersecurity at Oxford University, who's just going to do a complete number on Snowden, Prism, actually give us a few rules for figuring out how we go forward with that. But then I want people to go away from the major minds and enjoy themselves with, we've got something called a gastrodome on Sunday afternoon, which of course will be compelling everybody to eat their insect burgers and their algae pancakes with great alacrity. But the point is to have a kind of an entertaining talk about food futures, about the food chain, about synthetic biology and all those things. So synesthesia, I think, that idea that you can combine various senses and be wise in the middle of it, I think that's my thumbnail curation strategy for this. In discussion, I must say, with Jeff Mulgan, who has been a comrade of mine for many years since the days of Red Wedge, never mind New Labour. Him and I have kind of brewed this up together, and we're pretty proud of it.
Thank you very much for joining us, Pat. We look forward to seeing what the weekend brings, and you can find out more at futurefest.org. Two apparently unrelated big things in the photography world happened in 2012. First, 124-year-old photo giant Kodak went out of business. The company had failed to innovate because they didn't see digital photography as a threat to good old Kodachrome. Second, Instagram, an online social network that takes photos on a mobile phone and makes them look like they've been shot on Kodachrome, was sold to Facebook for an astonishing $1 billion. Now, Instagram has more than 150 million accounts registered with its service. And this week, Jemima met with Emily White, the company's new senior director of business, to find out how they plan to make their next billion. Jemima, give me an overview of what Instagram is.
Well, for the uninitiated or anybody without a camera phone, I suspect, it's an app. You take a picture, you add, if you like, a filter, and there's lots that are fairly retro, so they give you a kind of sepia tint or a bit of maybe a black and white a black and white filter or something. And then you decide where you want to share the picture to, whether that's Facebook or Tumblr or Twitter or wherever, and then you send it out. It's basically a shareable version of Hipstamatic, which those of you who are into your photography apps will have used first. But Instagram bettered that by adding sharing. And it was just, it's a perfect example of the right product at the right time. It hit massive mainstream take-up of smartphones. It hit an appetite to do more with images because Flickr was obviously quite slow in bringing its mobile app up to speed. And Instagram, to some extent, fulfilled that role. For Facebook, who had been under intense scrutiny for a lack of a robust mobile strategy, this $1 billion acquisition, which a lot of people in the tech industry were just astonished at, but this was Facebook very much putting its money where its mouth needed to be, and that resulted in the Instagram acquisition.
You spoke with Emily White, Instagram's Senior Director of Business Development this week. Who is she? Where did she come from?
Well, she's an interesting case, actually. She's very professional, very Californian, very executive, very much in the mold of Sheryl Sandberg, who worked with her at Google a few years ago. Sheryl moved to Facebook, obviously, as chief operating officer, and Emily moved to Facebook as well. And then when Instagram was taken on and needed to be kind of commercialized, Sheryl has kind of anointed Emily as the person to do it. So she's had the spotlight thrust on her in a way.
And why is Instagram in town? Is it a beauty pageant so people can check out the new business director, or is it something else that they're offering?
It's literally a beauty pageant because it has been Fashion Week. Instagram is perhaps cleverly positioning itself not just to technologists and to people interested in photography, but to the fashion community, who understandably have picked up quite enthusiastically on Instagram because it's primarily a visual medium, obviously. But what Emily is charged with doing is making money from Instagram. And the way that they will do that, I think we can most accurately look to Twitter as an example of how they'll be doing that, through promoted tweets, so sponsored posts and sponsored comments, sponsored accounts to follow. And also we could look to technology like Kiosk, which lets you click on clothing in videos to buy it. This is very nascent technology at the moment, and how it will work on mobile is yet to be decided, but there's definitely huge potential, and Instagram is very much building up its profile and courting brands and advertisers for the future.
When Instagram was acquired by Facebook, it was 16 employees. It was really small. And about 6 months in, they announced that they had 100 million users. And so one of the first things I did when I came in was map out a plan with Kevin on how we were going to scale this as a real business. And what that means is making sure when users have issues and they need a response, that we're taking care of them. Scaling our community organization that publishes the Instagram blog, making sure that we're building out a partnerships organization, and also eventually turning this into a real business that makes money. And so it's one of several things that I focus on. It's probably the hardest part of my job in thinking about this, in that we have such a special product that is embraced by people all over the world. We have 150 million users now. And it's very personal, right? It's photos and videos from their friends and family, from public figures that they relate to, and also brands. And so as part of this, you know, we're looking a lot at how people are using this and connecting with branded content already. So that's the kind of where our mind is right now.
How do you go from popular to profitable, though? Because there's a big difference between the two. You've got 150 million users a month globally. How do you make money from that, though? And is this why you've introduced video? That's really what video is about, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. We actually did get that question a lot when we launched video. Totally unrelated. What we always ask ourselves is, what is right for Instagram? And and the decision to become a business that makes money is not separate from that, but it's independent of the consumer products that we launch. You know, there's something that is really interesting that happens on Instagram that doesn't happen on other social media, and that's how the users look at their feed. So if you go to a Twitter or a Facebook, you often look at someone's post and or you look at someone who's written a post and you say, is that person funny? Do they normally have interesting things to say? And then make a judgment and decide to read that content or not. Instagram, the model is completely flopped on its head, right? You're looking at your feed and you come across beautiful images and videos and you say, God, I love this, or I don't love it. Who posted it? And because of that flop, there's a really interesting opportunity for people who you may not be connected to, public figures, people who are really popular on Instagram, and brands to connect with users in a way that they're maybe not used to. It's almost without judgment. And so we have an interesting ecosystem where people are connecting with individuals and brands that they don't necessarily know or they don't know personally. And they're connecting with the content directly. And that community is posting really good content because they know that that model has shifted. So really good content is king.
Is it sensible then for us to look at Twitter, given how close your growth has been tied to Twitter? Should we look at their ad products?
you know, I we get this type of question all of the time. No, it's okay. No, I'm not. That was not a criticism of the question at all. It's just that there is constantly in the media from marketers, people want to know, who are you like, right? I need a paradigm to compare ourselves to. And I would say that ultimately what we really want to build is a suite of products, whether they're directly consumer products or they are marketer products that work really well on our platform. I would say that if you're looking for an analogy, what I would probably use is more like the magazine industry, because I think that's what our consumer experience is like today, right? Where you wake up in the morning and you open up Instagram and you get this feed of beautiful content from a wide variety of sources. And the consumption experience is really pleasurable and beautiful. And it's much like opening up a magazine, right? I mean, I'm like a huge avid home decorator and I sit and I just like, it's like visual chocolate, right? It's just looking at these beautiful images and some of it's commercial and some of it's editorial and the line is really blurred actually.
Given that obviously you're owned by Facebook, to what extent should we be thinking of Instagram as the mobile incarnation of Facebook, as a key indicator of the kind of engagement that Facebook is looking at on mobile? Obviously, Facebook has its own mobile product, but Instagram has seen phenomenal growth in a way that Facebook itself hadn't been able to achieve so quickly.
Well, Facebook has had pretty phenomenal growth, too. The key differentiator early on was that Instagram was mobile first, but actually mobile only. And certainly, I mean, I think Mark has been very public about saying, if I had started Facebook 9 years after I actually did, I would have built a mobile company too. It's just the state of the world was so different then. Isn't that funny? It doesn't feel like it was that long ago. But and Kevin had the luxury of building a product for mobile and mobile only. In fact, I would say Instagram wouldn't exist had the mobile ecosystem not developed to where it is. You know, it used to be that we had cameras, but they weren't great quality. They certainly weren't with us all the time. And the onset of fantastic quality cameras in every single person's pocket connected to the internet has allowed really great things to happen. Facebook is doing really well on mobile as well. It's certain that Facebook has learned something from Instagram about how to be a mobile company. But we actually operate them as relatively independent companies. We have learned a ton from Facebook. We have been able to scale in a way that we would never have been able to had it not been for being part of Facebook. But they're two relatively different entities.
How are you going to encourage people to engage more in a more in a deeper way on Instagram? Is it enough to just say that you like a picture and then, you know, flick past?
Yeah. One of the things that is really special about Instagram is how much people actually do naturally engage. We certainly don't publish stats around this, but If you look at the percentage of one's follower base that engages with a photo, it's liking, it's commenting, or it's in some cases following, it's really high. It's much higher than you would expect. We don't do anything to drive that. The thing that drives it is both the product and people's experience with it, but also the community. It's been so interesting. I mean, I moved over to Instagram 6 months ago, and part of like one of the many things that I've loved about my job is talking to people who are just bonkers about Instagram. And I so frequently hear people saying about how they've met people, they've been to an Insta-meet, they have connected with people in parts of the world they never would have because of Instagram. So there's something about it that is magic, that's happening naturally without us doing anything, right?
What's the character of Instagram in the UK? What do we bring to the service that you don't get anywhere else?
The UK is our third largest region. So we are, it's funny, as a team, I think Kevin and team came out here about a year and a half ago, but this sort of most recent version of the incarnation of the team has not come. And we've had a fantastic time. I think in part seeing how the UK has embraced it very uniquely. I would say one of the interesting things about photos in general is that they are, you don't need words to get across an idea. And the UK this week has been a perfect example of Fashion Week, right? Where so many of the UK designers have gotten on and use an Instagram as their primary mechanism to show the behind the scenes, experience their latest fashion. So it's this really interesting blend of like hyper local, but also global at the same time.
You must have a huge amount on your to-do list, but what's the most important thing? How much pressure are you under to make money, I suppose, and does that really determine what is at the top of your list, or is it still all about product?
You know, I feel so lucky that we are not under pressure to make money. People, this is also a common, like, is this a, especially when you're bought for $1 billion, right? I mean, you would assume that there would be some pressure, and we're not. The most important thing to me is that we can scale. We can continue to scale. The service is growing like gangbusters. People are taking to video really well. And that to keep up maintaining and supporting that growth is hard, actually. And we only have a team of 50 people. So it's how do we attract the best talent that we can? And also, how do we constantly challenge ourselves? Because when you have such fast growth, it's very easy to say, oh, this is going so well, we don't need to do much. And certainly, you know, the culture of the team is really important in making sure that we maintain our edge as an innovative company. You know, the challenge, I think, with a lot of tech companies is the need to disrupt yourself because things are changing so quickly.
You must have some very exciting plans on the drawing board, but how long before we could see, say, some of those brands in Fashion Week before we'd be able to click on an Instagram picture to buy the clothes in the picture?
Do you want to come work on our team to make and build that product?
I'll give it a try.
You know, we have said publicly that we will likely have some sort of advertising in the next year, and we'll start testing probably in the nearer term. We have all of the luxury and the ability to go really slow. So that's what you will expect from us, is that we will throw some things out there and see how it goes and take our time to get it right.
The luxury to go slow. Emily, yeah. That's fascinating. Thank you very much.
Of course, thank you.
That was Jemima Kish with Emily White of Instagram. You can see the video of some of this interview on theguardian.com/technology. That's it for this week. Thank you very much to the Tech Weekly team, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur, and to our special guests, Samuel Gibbs, Benedict Evans, and Pat Kane. This week's podcast was produced by Jason Phipps. We are back next week with even more from the tech world. No, it's true, more. And until then, I'm Alex Kratowski. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you will get 20% off in September by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.